beginners, your companion on the road to a calmer life. I hope you're happy. I hope you're peaceful. It's a pleasure to practice with you again. It's going to be a slightly different format today. I'm going to be talking to my friend and your friend, Katie Sheen, about some of the myths that exist around mindfulness. And then we're going to have a guided meditation from Joseph Hamer, who has written a book around mindfulness for children. We're also going to have a reading from one of Thich Nhat Hanh's books and a song at the end. We haven't done that in a long time. But first I wanted to just give you some news on the podcast. I wanted to say thank you to everybody for listening, and thank you for sharing the podcast on Facebook and Twitter. I really appreciate it. My motivation with the podcast is to share the practice with as many people as possible so that other people can have the same benefits that I've had from practicing mindfulness, which is really just a calmer, happier life. I also wanted to let you know that I'm planning to run Plum Village's mindfulness course called Be Calm, Be Happy. You can Google it to find out a little bit of information about it. But it's a really fantastic course which takes you through the fundamentals of mindfulness. It'll probably be early next year, January, February. If you're interested, then there's a link to the Facebook group in the description, so please connect on Facebook or give me a shout on Twitter. I'll put the email address in the description as well, so just let me know if you're interested. There'll probably be about 12 or 15 places, so the earlier you can let me know, the better. Just to let you know, if you haven't come across it in earlier episodes of the podcast, the course is run by Plum Village, and Plum Village is Thich Nhat Hanh's organization. Thich Nhat Hanh is the father of modern mindfulness in the West, and Plum Village is his organization that shares the practice across the world. And if you go to the Plum Village website, you can find your local Sangha and your local mindfulness group, which is one of the things that I talked to Katie about. So let me know if you're interested, and it would be great to share some of the fundamentals of the practice with you face to face. But first, we're going to have the chat with Katie. Katie is a great friend of mine. She's been practicing mindfulness for over 16 years. She is a qualified teacher of mindfulness, and I've certainly learned a huge amount from her. She's a powerful advocate for well-being and mental health, and she's just a bloody good person. So last time we talked about mindfulness and health and dealing with chronic pain. This time we were talking about some of the misconceptions that exist around mindfulness, and I started off by asking her about some of the common myths that she's come across.
Wow, there's so many misconceptions. One is that people think it's for hippies and it's about escaping from the world. And that's one that I love to bust straight away, because mindfulness for me is about developing an inner strength so that you can engage more effectively with the world. So there's just no point in meditating and escaping and then getting up and carrying on as though nothing has happened. And mindfulness is the opposite of that. So if you're meditating and you're using mindfulness meditation, you are developing skills that you then take out into life. So it's the opposite of escaping. I think of it as the equivalent of, if you want to play the piano, you have to practice the scales. And meditation in mindfulness for me is like practicing scales, and playing the piano is the whole of life.
It's really interesting, because the one of my reflections on this is that mindfulness has kind of revealed to me that I spent quite a lot of my time escaping and avoiding life and the emotions that I was feeling. And it's not until you sit down and spend some time scanning your thoughts and feelings that you can really be in touch with that. So, you know, for example, you know, watching TV or being on the internet is frequently a crutch for me whenever I'm having a stressful time or a difficult time. So in some ways, rather than escaping from life, it's not meeting it head on, but treating yourself kindly and acknowledging the mental state that you're in at the moment.
Yeah, I would totally agree. Is that I think it takes a huge amount of bravery to stop running through life and to see things more clearly and to, yeah, to face up to them. And to me, that's what mindfulness is about. So there's another misconception that it's all about focusing on the positive. And the only reason in mindfulness that you focus on the positive is so that you're in a resilient enough state of mind so that you can face the difficult. Mm. So the focusing on the positive is kind of a means to an end. And I also think it's really important that we have to remember, particularly when you're teaching mindfulness, but when you're discovering it as well, is that you have to know where you are when you first start practicing. And most of us come to it when we're actually in a really bad space. And so it's important that if you come to mindfulness and you're in a really bad space and you're feeling very overwhelmed by life, is that the first thing that you need to do is to actually settle your nervous system so that you can think more clearly, so that you can build in a strength to start actually engaging with life in a way so that you don't feel overwhelmed. So I think that that's why that myth has come about, because there are quite, well, I specialize in mindfulness for anxiety. So obviously it's really common that when I first see people, you know, a lot of them can hardly string a sentence together without crying, or, you know, they're in a really difficult place. And so the first thing that we do is focus on the positives, but that's not to deny the difficult stuff that's happening for them. It's to calm the nervous system down and build their inner strength so that they're calm enough to then look at why they're so anxious and then to act to do something about that. So maybe that myth comes about, I don't know, maybe people turn up to one lesson, it isn't explained properly, and they never go back. I don't know.
Yeah, I find whenever people talk to me about coming along to a Sangha or a mindfulness group, one of the things that they say is that, well, I can't do it because, you know, I have 100 thoughts a minute. And some of what they're describing makes it sound as if they really don't want to be alone with those thoughts. They're afraid to be with those thoughts. And, you know, if anything, that's such a strong reason to practice mindfulness, because if you're suffering to the point where you have to avoid the things that you're thinking and the things that you're feeling, then there's something that clearly needs to be addressed there.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think there's another myth that creeps in there as well, which is that people think that meditation and mindfulness is about clearing your mind, which is completely impossible. You know, your mind always has to be thinking about something. So for me, what mindfulness is all about is making me more aware of what I'm thinking about, which sounds a bit odd, but there are so many times where we're so completely caught in our thoughts that, and they're so powerful that we don't realize what a huge effect they are having on how we view the world, how we're holding our body, how we respond to things. They're just, our inner talk is so much a part of who we are that we don't notice it anymore. We can't see it clearly. So that initial part of mindfulness of stopping and listening to what you're actually thinking, for me, I feel is the first way that we increase our awareness and the first time that we wake up, and waking up, being more aware of what's really going on in life, to me is what mindfulness is, I was going to say all about, mindfulness is so broad and so deep, I'm not sure I could sum it up in one sentence. But that for me is a really crucial part of it, is I am constantly amazed at how often I am caught up in my thoughts and how powerful they are for influencing the way that I interpret the world and the way that I respond to it. So I think you're so right, is that if people are frightened about sitting down and listening to their thoughts, that's a really good reason to start practicing mindfulness.
I always tell people that no one can sit for 20 minutes without having a thought. Thich Nhat Hanh can't do it, the Dalai Lama can't do it. So the practice of mindfulness isn't about trying to clear your mind, because you're setting yourself up for failure. And I think that's what people see. They see themselves failing in it. And it's, I suppose it leads on as well to, it's really not helpful to be attached to a particular result when you're, starting off with mindfulness as well. It's not about, success or failure, but really giving yourself a chance to explore what is it that's actually going through your head from moment to moment, and the insight that actually offers you. Because if you notice a thought, say when you're anxious or when you're angry, and if you notice a thought that's coming through and you catch it and you have it in your hand, if you like, to extend the metaphor, and then you ask yourself, what's the roots of this thought in my past? It can actually open up a huge amount of insight to why in a particular situation you will feel anxious or you start to get angry. It's so revealing. It is such a critical part of the practice.
Yeah, I totally agree. Totally agree. I mean, I feel as though I know myself so much better now. Mm. And also, because I can see clearly when I'm going down one of those routes of, oh, you know, this is kind of a reaction that's kicked off in me, mindfulness enables me to see it and just to take a breath and think, is this really how I want to react or respond here? You know, obviously we're trying to move from reaction, meaning that you haven't really got any control over it, that's just what happens, to actually having choice and therefore responding rather than reacting. So for me as well, that's why it's just the opposite of being hippie, whatever you interpret that to mean. But for me, it's definitely about being more focused, having a much stronger sense of just an ability to focus more, an inner strength, somewhere peaceful to go back to, so that, and also an awareness that my thoughts are just thoughts. So I am not my thoughts. I am much more than that. So if there's an anxious thought coming back into my body. So one thing, obviously, you know, with COVID-19, it's a really anxious time for everybody, and, you know, myself very much included in that. So when I feel that I'm getting anxious about things, mindfulness enables me to see, oh, I've got anxious thoughts going on at the moment. Are they actually being helpful? Because if I'm out shopping, actually, it's quite useful to feel a bit of anxiety, because I do need to be aware of where I am and have I got my mask on and all of that kind of stuff. So a certain degree of anxiety is useful. But if my anxiety is out of control, then I've been working on breathing really deep into my abdomen and building a sense of safety and security so that I can come back to that, so that my anxiety drops enough so that I can think clearly. Mm. Otherwise, I'm just in this heightened state of stress where, well, life's a bit of a mess, isn't it? For me anyway, when I'm like that, if I'm just running through life scared, nothing really works very well.
And that's, I mean, that leads on to another misconception as well, is that mindfulness isn't a magic wand. Throughout my life, I was always looking for something, the switch that would switch off my anxiety, and mindfulness is great and it's helped a lot, but mindfulness, there is no switch for your emotions, and mindfulness is not that switch. And sometimes there's a misconception that, you know, if you practice mindfulness, then all of the stressors in your life are going to go away. And really, it's about that second arrow that I've talked about in previous episodes, where events are events. Things are going to happen that will bring you joy. things are going to happen that will be very difficult, that might make you sad and might make you anxious. So things will happen in your life, events will happen, but mindfulness has a strong influence with practice over your reaction to it, because a lot of the time, much of our suffering comes from our reaction to events more than the events themselves.
Absolutely. And I think another thing that happens with mindfulness is that you get much more comfortable about feeling strong emotions. So, you know, I can feel a really strong, like a wave of grief or anger or whatever it happens to be. And that ability to go, wow, this is strong, and have that inner strength or that sense of solidity that you think, well, if I wait, though, that will pass, and then I'll be able to think more clearly and respond to that. And if I am feeling grief, how do I need to take care of myself? How am I going to reach out? You know, so there's that kindness element of it. And so for me, mindfulness has enabled me to be much more comfortable about really strong emotions. So it's not that I've reached some kind of state where I don't feel things. I think in a way, I feel things more, but react less.
Yeah. You know, yeah, yeah.
It takes away, I don't know about you, but for me, it takes away some of the fear of the future, because I think, you know, I mean, I don't do this perfectly by any stretch of the imagination, but it makes me much more confident that whatever life will throw my way, I will be able to cope with that.
Yeah.
You know, because I'll be able to be not completely overwhelmed by the strong emotions, because I'll be able to think, wow, this is really difficult, so I'm just going to breathe, stay in the center of this, and maybe at that point turn to the positive because it's overwhelming at the moment, just to build my resilience so that now I can deal with what is difficult. So it's very much about acting, you know, actually participating.
Yeah, and that brings to mind something that I realized earlier on this year, which was, like, I have quite a lot of social anxiety. That's the core of my anxiety. And I was the kind of person, and I'm sure there's lots of people that are listening to this would be the same, who gets embarrassed very easily. So you're afraid of saying the wrong thing all the time. But I realized that the saying the wrong thing wasn't the problem. And actually, the embarrassment wasn't even the problem. It was my fear of the embarrassment. And then what do I do then? And what I have realized is that mindfulness has helped with a huge amount, is that whenever I'm in a social situation and there's a perception inside me, a thought that arises that I shouldn't have said that, or I should have said something different, and there's an emotion that comes along with that I can take a step back and observe it. It doesn't overwhelm me in the same way that it used to. And that's such a, like, I looked for years for something that would help with that. And it's just such an incredible thing. And it's part of the reason why I just, you know, I'm probably sick. People are probably sick of me talking about mindfulness, but it's part of the reason why I want to share it with people, because it can genuinely make that difference.
Definitely. And so, the other way of thinking about that as well is, the way that I think about it is that it helps me to move towards the difficulties in my life rather than running away from them.
Yeah.
You know, because I feel as though I've got more tools to deal with them. I'm, as you say, I'm less frightened of feeling those difficult things. And if I do feel those difficult things, then yeah, there's that ability to look more deeply at what's going on and to gain clarity. So for me, mindfulness is about an increased level of awareness, which therefore enables me to gain greater clarity. And once that I can see things more differently, I can respond in ways that I couldn't have done before. So I feel much less pushed around by life. And also sometimes I've got the confidence to just let life overwhelm me. You know, there's been some really tough times during this lockdown where I have felt quite overwhelmed, and I've noticed that I can just go, wow, feeling completely overwhelmed today, so, you know, fine. I'm just going to feel overwhelmed and not panic about the fact that I feel overwhelmed. And therefore, by responding to that sense of overwhelm with calmness, it's able to move away more quickly. But just as you say, it also means that I'm then calm enough about feeling overwhelmed to go, wow, well, this is really interesting. So why am I feeling overwhelmed? And what can I do about it? So there's this word in mindfulness that they talk about accepting life as it is. And I think that's a really difficult translation, because accepting in our culture means a certain element of giving up and letting it just do its own thing. So it might be more helpful to think of it more as allowing. So I'm allowing myself to admit that I'm feeling overwhelmed. And because I'm not fighting it and trying to push it away and deny it, I can look at it more calmly and then see why the emotion is there. And then you can find a way to transform it potentially.
Yeah. And you know, I always say to people that it's okay to not be okay. So whenever things are feel like they're going off the rails, or you feel very anxious or you feel very sad, that giving yourself permission to feel what you're feeling, rather than it being an automatic hit the alarm, because if I'm feeling this way, then things must be, terrible or catastrophic. It's just noticing it, being with it, and we all have those days. And I have those days sometimes where it's like, I'm feeling terrible today. And it's like, okay, what's going through my head? What am I feeling emotionally? What am I feeling physically? And just giving yourself permission and a bit of space to feel that. And the thing is, that leads on nicely to one of the other misconceptions around practice, which is that you don't have to practice for 20 years to be able to do that. It's a framework, and it's a way of approaching things that really doesn't take years of practice to get into the habit of. It does take a little bit of training. It does take a little bit of persistence, and ideally a bit of practice every day. But I think an example just from one of the books that's out there, one of the frameworks that's out there, and Paul Williams is one of the kind of leading thinkers around mindfulness, and his program suggests 10 minutes a day for 6 weeks. And I think giving people an idea of when you can see some real benefits from it, I think that that's kind of the realistic time scales of starting to see the benefits of mindfulness. I think I was very lucky, because in the first session that I went to, I could feel a difference. I noticed it, and it just felt like the framework that I was always looking for. But I think I was very lucky. I think that's an exception. But I think for most people, I think that you can see benefits from the practice and being able to take a step back and look at what you're thinking and feeling within a few weeks.
Yeah. And like you say, I think it does just depend as well. What kind of class you're at, and whether it's actually, this sounds a bit old, but whether it's actually teaching you what is relevant to you, where you are in that moment. Because I teach these weekly mindfulness for anxiety classes, and it's actually really common that somebody will come back for the second class going, oh my goodness, that made such a difference. But it won't necessarily have been that they've been meditating all that time, but just one of the ideas from mindfulness has enabled them to see life a bit differently, or to see their responses a bit differently. And as you say, just a really simple little practice, you know, just coming back to their breathing 3 times and noticing what they're thinking. Or any of the other, you know, myriad of little mindfulness practices there are, will have made a difference almost immediately. And it's that slight kind of like, oh, I never thought about life like that before. That was certainly my first introduction to mindfulness was through a book, a Zen book that I read. And I remember reading bits of it and just thinking, oh my goodness, I just, never thought of it like that before. It's like a light going on. So I think that you can certainly get a sense of the possibility that there is a different way of being in the world. And once you start to see that possibility, I think the depth and the breadth of mindfulness is just phenomenal. You know, however long we all practice, I mean, I've only been practicing about 16 years, something like that. And I still learn so much every week of just like, wow, I just never quite understood it like that before. Because I've never been quite like this before, you know, it sounds a bit cliche saying it now, particularly when we're talking about mindfulness, but we do change in each moment. You know, I've never lived through a pandemic before. I've never been this age before. I've never had this set of circumstances. So obviously how I feel in the present moment, I've never felt this before. But there's always one element of mindfulness that I find will help me whenever I'm feeling lost. And that's obviously what it is, isn't it? It's a path. It gives me a sense of when I get lost and lose my way and wander off. It's just like, oh, hang on, I've lost my way a bit here. And the mindfulness teachings give me something very solid and practical and realistic and achievable to come back to. And I'm hugely grateful for that.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And that kind of opportunity to see the world in a different way, or how things can be different, I would have to say going along to your local Sangha is incredibly important for that, and practicing with other people, because I feel like one of the kind of revolutionary things for me was seeing how the world could be different. And it was through Sangha, through seeing how people can relate to each other, how they can be really open with what they're feeling with each other, and how actually you can see how conflicts can be resolved in a way that increases and strengthens a relationship between people as well. Through Sangha, I saw that there's a different world that is ready to exist if we're more present with what we're feeling in the moment. So it's something I would absolutely recommend. And if you want to find out where your local mindfulness group, your local Sangha is, if you go onto the Plum Village website, there'll be one near you. There's one last one, which I think might be the strangest one out of all of them, but it was just something that somebody threw into a casual conversation with me, which was, isn't mindfulness a selfish practice? So there's all of these problems that exist in the world, and so you're going away to your room and you're focusing on yourself and your breathing for you know, 20 minutes or whatever it is. I mean, what's your thoughts on that, Katie?
Well, the only real, it's a great question, and I think it is a real misconception, and I do wonder as well whether some people feel a bit guilty about the whole idea of doing it. But the reason that we practice is so that we can engage more constructively with the world. So you're only withdrawing to practice, and obviously we're only talking here about a seated meditation, which is one part of the practice. You know, mindfulness is a way of being in the world. As I say, you know, to if we go back to that analogy of your seated meditation is like practicing the scales, then you have to do that in order to play the whole symphony, and the symphony is life. And so Thich Nhat Hanh has a wonderful quote, which I can't remember word for word, but it's along the lines of there should be no such thing as an angry peace campaigner.
Yeah.
You know, and peace begins within. So if you are peaceful and you take that out into the world begins to transform. You know, if we think now about, and that for me is how I think about being. So if I know somebody who, as soon as I see, they walk into the room, they're calm, they're relaxed, but they've got this inner strength, they're positive, they look you in the eye, they listen to you properly, they're really present for you. It's such a powerful experience. And so that the way that they are in themselves affects me and everyone they come into contact with. And so that for me is why mindfulness practice is not selfish. It would be if all you ever did was, you know, a 20 minutes meditation and then got up and carried on as though nothing had happened. But mindfulness isn't like that. When you really engage with it, it touches every single aspect of your life. And that's a wonderful thing.
That's absolutely right. And the way I like to think of it is, if you imagine yourself as, you know, someone who's campaigning on a particular issue, or campaigning for peace in the world or whatever it is, you know, how often are you going to be working on that? I like to think of the campaign for peace in the world as being an everyday thing, and you can only radiate peace into the world in your everyday campaign if you are in a peaceful state. And if you're feeling anxious all the time, if you're feeling stressed all the time, if you're feeling down, then you can do, you know, you can still do lots of great things to make the world a better place. But yeah. The best thing that you can do is to improve how you're feeling, to address the difficult emotions, to increase your calmness. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, there can be no peace in the world without peace in oneself, and that's absolutely where it has to start.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Yeah. So it's definitely not a selfish thing. Imagine if everyone in the world practiced mindfulness and became peaceful. It would transform things.
Yeah.
So could that be selfish?
Imagine if Donald Trump practiced mindfulness.
That would really be very helpful, wouldn't it?
Anyway, I should move on from that because it's, I'm moving this into the slightly political territory. But I wanted to kind of draw attention to the resources that are available. So I've mentioned going to your local Sangha, which is really helpful. There's the Plum Village app. There's great books by Thich Nhat Hanh, which explain the basics of what mindfulness is. Peace is Every Step is a great place to start. Happiness is a great place to start. You're a fantastic mindfulness teacher, Katie. I mean, I've been in one of your classes. I've learned a huge amount from you. Do you want to just talk about the courses that you offer?
Yeah, sure. So like you, I practice in the Plum Village tradition. So I go to two different sanghas each week. So I go to Heart of Manchester and Stockport. So, and I completely agree with you, is that it's so important to have that community. So I practice mindfulness with other people almost as much as I teach it. So I am a mindfulness teacher, but I'm still very much practicing. And yeah, without the wider community, I'm just passing on the teachings, obviously, or they're passing through me. So I, in terms of resources that I have, I offer weekly mindfulness for anxiety classes. But I teach the Plum Village course called Be Calm, Be Happy. So that's the 6-week course where we first met, of course, as you say. I also do a range of webinars and that kind of thing. I've got a 1-hour course which consists of multiple short videos, each about 1 to 4 minutes long. And that's a course called Mindfulness for Anxiety, hosted on the Udemy e-learning platform. And I made that free at the beginning of the pandemic, and it's now being watched in 110 countries, which is amazing.
Fantastic.
And I've got, there's an app that goes with that called Appreciating Windowsills, which is helping us to connect more positively with the world around us. And I developed that as I was recovering from cancer. That was a way of helping me to process the trauma of my experience, which takes us back to that point we were making before, is that we focus on the positive in mindfulness for a very good reason, which is to build our resilience and make us feel more connected in a more positive way to the world around us. It's one aspect of the practice. So I've got that as well. So yeah, there's lots of options out there for people. And obviously you do a wonderful thing with this podcast. It's a fantastic resource for people. So thank you so much for inviting me. I'm very grateful for all that you do and all the peace that you're putting out into the world. Thanks, Sean. Yeah.
It's an absolute honour to have you on, and it's been fantastic talking to you. So, Katie, may you be happy, may you be peaceful, may you be healthy, and live a long life.
Thank you, Sean. Exactly the same for you and for everyone listening.
Your friend and mine, Katie Sheen. Recently, I've been thinking about how mindfulness could have the biggest impact in the world, and one of the areas that came to mind is in schools. So if we can support children to lead calmer, happier lives, if we can support them to deal with their emotions in a constructive way, accept the happiness, but also the anger, the anxiety, the sadness, then we could create a wonderful world for the future. And I happen to run into a man by the name of Joseph Hamer, who has written a book on teaching mindfulness to children, and it's well worth a look. And I asked Joseph if he'd be prepared to come on and do a bit of an introduction to the book and a guided meditation. And he has. So here's Joseph.
My name is Joseph Hamer, and I'm an elementary educator and the co-author of the new activity book called Brain Awakes, Empowering Children Through Breath, Balance, and Reflection. If you're willing, I would like to sit with you today and meditate on a topic that nearly every one of us have felt in the recent weeks and months: anxiety. The word itself brings flutters to our hearts and stirring to our guts, but I invite you to be still. Sit. Breathe. Be mindful. Anxiety is the physical outcome of our fear, our worry, or our lack of control. If you fill your brain with anxiety, there is no room for peace. But if you fill your brain with peace, there will be no room for anxiety. Worrying does not solve any problem. In fact, we recognize that it often makes it worse. There are reasons to worry everywhere and every day, but the anxiety only prolongs the suffering. Today, I encourage you to be still. Let your thoughts flow freely like the clouds in the sky. Do not grasp for them. Breathe mindfully with me. Be present. When you find yourself clinging to a thought, breathe deeply and let it go. As you may find yourself anxious, find comfort in your mindful breaths. Enable yourself to fill your heart with peace. For today, I would invite you to say the mantra. Breathing in, I find the present moment. Breathing out, I find a peaceful moment. Breathing in, I find the present moment. Breathing out, I find a peaceful moment. Present moment, peaceful moment. I'll invite the sound of the bell to begin our meditation and to conclude it. Sit tall, close your eyes, and find your breath. If you find yourself distracted, simply return to your breath. Thank you. present moment, peaceful moment. Present moment, peaceful moment. Present moment, peaceful moment. Present moment, peaceful moment. Thank you. invite you to open your eyes. For those of you with children, we share our anxiety with our children. We are not alone in this struggle. Anxiety in our children can look like a change in sleeping patterns, a change in eating patterns, quick to anger, obsessive in organization and collecting for control, if you notice that something is just different, I would encourage you to sit with your child and breathe with them and teach them the mantra, breathing in, I find the present moment, breathing out, I find a peaceful moment, breathing in, I find the present moment, breathing out, I find a peaceful moment. Present moment. Peaceful moment. As your day continues, I hope that you stay in the present moment and that you find it to be a peaceful moment. I trust that your heart will be full of peace, that it'll overflow onto those around you, that your presence will comfort, will hold, will cradle those around you. Thank you for taking the time to sit with me today. Namaste.
Many thanks to Joseph. I thought I'd finish off this extended episode with a reading from Thich Nhat Hanh and a song at the end, which, spoiler alert, is going to be Easy by the Commodores, if you know it. I talk a lot about Thich Nhat Hanh during the podcast. I kind of quote a snippet from him here and there, but it's not that often that I take the time to read his words, and I really do think that it's worthwhile getting hold of one of his books, because everything that I know comes from Thich Nhat Hanh. Sometimes it's via other people like Katie. But if you're enjoying the podcast, I'd really recommend going back to the source, because he has a way of describing things and a way of reaching out to people and a way of making mindfulness accessible that I think is absolutely amazing. So I'm just going to read a passage from his book, Happiness. And it's called, I Have Arrived, I Am Home. Imagine you're on a plane flying to New York. Once you sit down in the plane, you think, I have to sit here for 6 hours before I arrive. Sitting in the plane, you think only of New York, and you're not able to live the moments that are offered to you now. But it is possible for you to walk on the plane in such a way that you enjoy every step. You don't need to arrive in New York in order to be peaceful and happy. As you walk onto the plane, every step brings you happiness, and you arrive in every moment. To arrive means to arrive somewhere. And when we practice walking meditation, we arrive in every moment. We arrive at the destination of life. The present moment is a destination. Breathing in, I make a step and another step, and I tell myself, I have arrived, I have arrived. I have arrived is our practice. When we breathe in, we take refuge in our in-breath and we say, I have arrived. When we make a step, we take refuge in our step and we say, I have arrived. This is not a statement to yourself or another person. I have arrived means I have stopped running. I have arrived in the present moment because only the present moment contains life. When I breathe in and take refuge in my in-breath, I touch life deeply. When I take a step and I take refuge entirely in my step, I also touch life deeply, and by doing so, I stop running. Stopping running is a very important practice. We have been running all our life. We believe that peace, happiness, and success are present in some other place and time. We don't know that everything, peace, happiness, and stability, should be looked for in the here and now. This is the address of life, the intersection of here and now. When we practice this meditation, we arrive in each moment. Our true home is in the present moment. When we enter the present moment deeply, our regrets and sorrows disappear, and we discover life with all its wonders. And now, dear friends, we've reached the end of this super special extended episode. I'm going to do a song now. It's not one of the Plum Village songs because I only know a few of them and I don't know how to play them on guitar. But if you know the song, then you might want to sing along. And if you don't know the song, then feel free to either end the episode early, or you might choose to listen to my bum notes. But either way, may you be happy, may you be peaceful, may you be healthy, live a long life.
Sounds funny, but I just can't stand the pain. Girl, I'm leaving you tomorrow. Girl, you know I've done all I can. You see a big stone and a borrowed. Yeah. Sunday morning, yeah. It's why. wanna be free.